Thank you very much. And there's another book by the three of us due to come out next month called Spiritual Narrative in Clinical Psychiatry. So I won't tell you more about it. Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you. It's lovely meeting people early on in their career and with all the enthusiasm and the excitement of not knowing where it's going to go and what they're going to find. And I hope all of you find a lot and get a long way. Yes. So, so here we are. Is faith delusion? And well, this is a talk based on my experience, and in fact the very first time I had this title was before Dawkins' book came out. I was asked to talk about Is Faith a Delusion here in Oxford, and since that time I've had an interest in this area, and then with the publication of that book I realised it needed answering, and so it became more specific. But throughout my life I've been interested, as you've heard, in the interface between mental illness and religious or spiritual experience. I think I'm going to move on to here. Why is it not what I say? Okay, thank you. So that's a book. That is a monument. I'm not going to say more about that. But what I do want to say is you must be mad to believe that. Now, this is something which is said quite often, but the claim of some non-believers that faith in God is madness is very ancient indeed. It's one of the oldest put-downs in history, and it's based on the abuser's limitations, not the victim's mental state. When St. Paul, if you remember, gave a detailed and rational explanation of his faith before the Roman authorities, Festus, the governor, said, "You're out of your mind. Your great learning is driving you mad." Much more recently, Freud, in Moses and Monotheism, stated that belief in a single God is delusional. More recently, the British populist of science, I think that's the best way to describe him, Richard Dawkins, has claimed that God is delusion. To be more accurate in making his point, he should have put it that belief in God is delusional. Tony Blair realised that his faith was expressed as in a very hostile environment in Britain. It's difficult if you talk about religious faith in our political system. If you're in the American political system or other, then you can talk about religion or religious faith and people say, yeah, that's fair enough. And it is something they respond to quite naturally. You talk about it in our system and people do think you're a nutter. Believers throughout almost every other sphere of society would echo his exasperated comment in what is acceptable in British political and public life. Mention God and you're a nutter. faith is delusion. These epithets show current interest in an area when science, technology, and market forces appear to explain all of human choice and variation. So, people believe in God, and the rest of the world feels that this is quite unjustified. To claim that such people are simply primitive and ill-educated is not convincing. There are many graduates, a substantial number in science and medicine amongst believers. An alternative explanation is that such people must be mad or at least mentally disturbed. Spiritual concerns are very important for many patients, but doctors, and especially psychiatrists, have often completely overlooked these sides to life. More importantly, for suffering patients, many doctors have, without examining the evidence, assumed that religious belief is bad for your health. And this is described in great detail in this account by a patient. She was a teenager, a Christian, in the north of England, and she was admitted to mental hospital. And she had conversation with her psychiatrist, who repeatedly disparaged her faith, and sadly she abandoned it. If they wanted me to relinquish all thoughts of God, why didn't they do something to help me so that life could be bearable, even happy, without a God to believe in? Instead, they kept on subjecting me to treatment which made me cry out in desperation to this remote, perhaps fictitious God to help me. More than ever before, I wanted and needed him now. When Jean was first admitted to a hospital, her doctor said to her, "Hell doesn't exist. The Bible isn't meant to be taken literally. It's full of metaphors. Heaven doesn't exist either. The world's moved on from fairy tales to science." The doctor sighed. "But really, love, you ought to have had more sense than to try to believe things like that in the first place, don't you think?" I'm ashamed that someone from my profession could have been so crass. It did not, if Jean was done enormous harm by this, why did it happen? By the end of the 20th century, the attitude of many psychiatrists towards the beliefs of their patients and organized religion in general was really quite negative. And by the middle of the 20th century, it had been hostile. The churches had a deep distrust of psychiatry, regarding it as at best useless and at worst promoting atheism and amorality, and psychiatry regarded religion as being unhelpful and sometimes preventing people requiring treatment receiving it. Over more recent years, there has been some degree of reconciliation between these opposing positions. John Swinton, a theologian and previously a psychiatric nurse, has shown that in mental health, the professionals need to speak and think in the language of spirituality, focusing on meaning, hope, value. connectedness and transcendence, as well as the language of psychiatry and psychology. They need to be bilingual. Is faith delusion? Is not a simple question of fact. It comes with its own history of conflict. I guess Mark could tell us a lot more about that. Patients want more emphasis put on the spiritual aspects of psychiatric care and mental health, and mental health professionals need to take their beliefs into account. It is we, mental health professionals, who have lagged behind the requests and requirements of our patients. Over the next few minutes, I want to talk about the following questions. Why has there been hostility between religious faith and psychiatry? Is there necessarily a difference of opinion between scientific psychiatry and Christian faith? Is Christian faith harmful towards mental health? What is delusion? Why can faith not be delusional? Could faith be a psychiatric symptom other than delusion? Is it psychiatric illness or religious experience? So why the hostility between religious faith and psychiatry? The earliest references to the mind and mental illness in the Hebrew scriptures, Homeric epics, and Pharaonic writings made no distinction between religion and mental ideas. There was no conflict because there was no psychiatry. Benevolent care for mentally ill people started in religious houses in the Middle Ages, alongside looking after lepers and others with chronic diseases. Mental illness was a Renaissance concept, and sufferers were shown understanding and compassion. Some in the church had blamed demons for madness, but those with a more humane approach considered it to be illness of the mind, and that is very much a Renaissance phrase. The polarization greatly increased during the centuries of the witch hunts, when some mentally ill people were identified as witches and burnt. This resulted in a major rift between medical and theological theories for the origin of what we now call psychiatric disorders. When psychiatry became a distinct medical discipline about 1800, developments in the specialty resulted in medical reductionism. In Germany, Wilhelm Griesinger, regarded as the first biological psychiatrist, stated that patients with so-called mental illnesses are really individuals with illnesses of the nerves and brain. All sort of mental states and behaviour were considered to be based on disturbance of brain function. During the 19th century, so-called moral treatment was developed, particularly in this country. The principles were paying attention to the well-being of the patient, providing optional social conditions within the hospital, and bolstering self-respect and esteem. This had significant beneficial effects on care for patients. Treating them with dignity produced improvements in their mental state. On the other hand, the theory of degeneration, which arose out of Darwinian natural selection, had virtually halted efforts to treat those in mental hospitals by the end of the 19th century. In the first half of the 20th century, psychiatry became more rationalist and reductionist. by the middle of the century, with a huge gulf, with mutual suspicion, there was a huge gulf with mutual suspicion between the church and the psychiatric establishment. Psychiatrists considered that religion was at best irrelevant for patients and sometimes harmful by preventing them receiving the treatment they needed. Religious people regarded psychiatry as unhelpful entirely. The second half of the century saw a very gradual reduction and resolution. Attitudes within psychiatry towards religion have changed dramatically in the last part of the 20th century, and psychiatry is more prepared to acknowledge the importance of their patients' beliefs. Most churches are more prepared for their members to use psychiatric treatment. Is there a difference of opinion between scientific psychiatry and Christian faith? Science has increased our ability to treat patients. For example, bipolar disorder can usually be managed adequately nowadays. There's no conflict between science and faith when the boundaries of their separate realms are maintained. However, when science becomes scientism and a way of life, there is a tendency to regard everything else not amenable to scientific inquiry as irrelevant. Religious belief in healthy people cannot be explained, and so belief is considered irrational and hence delusional. Christian doctors and patients alike welcome the application of advances in neuroscience to psychiatric treatment, but when science has become dogma, it has ceased to be a tool for research and become a philosophy or even a religion. Because we can locate an experience or behaviour in the brain, it does not mean that that idea is meaningless or non-existent, just a byproduct of neurological metabolism. I see my beautiful cherry tree every May with my occipital cortex, the back part of my brain, that I can locate where the visual sensation is registered does not mean that the experience itself is meaningless, nor that the cherry tree does not exist. And you can take that a lot further with regards to religion. No, scientific psychiatry and Christian faith are not necessarily opposed to each other. In fact, together they can make an important contribution to the well-being of people whom they are both trying to help. When the establishments of science and religion have strayed outside their areas, there has been acrimony, and this has been harmful to mentally ill patients who are trapped in the middle. Is religious belief harmful towards mental health? Well, I no longer have to take a lot of time in answering that question, because in the last few years there has been a large amount of research on outcome for those with religious commitment and also suffering various mental illnesses. The evidence linking health with religious belief and practice has been gathered together in the second edition of the Handbook of Religion and Health by Koenig, King and Carson. It reviews more than 3,000 quantitative database studies exploring the relationship between religion, spirituality, and mental and physical health conditions. Most studies find a positive relationship between religion, spirituality, and good mental and physical health. The authors looked at mental and social health and found that in the great majority of studies, religious involvement is correlated positively with these qualities. And I'm just going to put them up and read them, but there is a mass of data on each one. So religious involvement is correlated with well-being, happiness and life satisfaction, hope and optimism, purpose and meaning in life, higher self-esteem, better adaptation to bereavement, greater social support and less loneliness, lower rates of depression, faster recovery from depression, lower rates of suicide, less anxiety, less psychosis, lower rates of alcohol and drug abuse, less delinquency and criminal activity, greater marital stability and satisfaction. Huge number of different factors have been explored with considerable detail. So there are direct benefits of belief and practice, such as being more optimistic and coping better in response to stressful circumstances. There are also indirect effects, including lifestyle and social support. And adding all these together, there is a remarkable degree of correlation between religious involvement and better mental and also physical health. With depressive illness, for instance, 65% of studies reported significant benefit from religious involvement. Findings can be summarized. Those with Christian belief and practice have a lower risk for developing depressive disorder and symptoms, and religious activity may lead to a reduction in depressive symptoms. In particular, involvement in religious community activities, being a member of a church, for instance, and valuing faith highly, convey advantage and organisational, such as going to church, rather than private activities, give the most benefit. Religious involvement helps people to cope with stressful life events, which are often precursors to depressive illness. Religious belief is also a powerful protective factor from suicide and suicidal behaviour in children, adolescents and adults. The advantage of religious belief and spirituality for mental and physical health is one of the best kept secrets in psychiatry and medicine generally. If the finding of the huge volume of research on this topic had gone in the opposite direction and it had been found that religion damages your mental health, it would have been front page news in every newspaper in the land. What is delusion? Now, this may be a point at which you want to switch off, because I am going to get a little technical. I will talk about delusion. Delusion is now a psychiatric word. It belongs to psychiatry. And it is the task of a psychiatrist to say what is and is not delusion. In law, for example, delusion is the cardinal feature of insanity. Therefore, if faith is delusional, the believer is insane to believe it. We explore what is delusion by studying the subjective experience of those who suffer delusions. How can one study subjective experience? The psychiatrist tries to get beyond the words the patient uses to reach what they mean for this person using understanding and empathy. Understanding, in the sense described by Carl Jaspers, involves the use of empathy, that is, subjective observation of the patient's experience by the understander using her own qualities as a human being, both cognitive and emotional, feeling inside the other. The distinction between form and content is particularly important. Form indicates the type of abnormality of mental experience, such as false belief or depressed mood, whilst content reflects the predominant concerns of this patient arising from their own cultural and individual standpoint. This old lady, who has always been preoccupied with money and bankruptcy, may believe, erroneously, that the nurses are stealing her money. Delusions are held without insight. I do not know that I am deluded. Those deluded commonly show concrete thinking, converting the abstract or metaphorical into the physical or literal. A religious belief cannot be a group or shared delusion. Communicated delusion is quite different in nature and rarely shows religious content. Delusions cannot be shared because they are ultimately ununderstandable. One is unable to understand why another person could hold that particular belief with delusional intensity. Although John Smith and William Brown both believed that they are Jesus Christ, their inpatients in a mental hospital, John Smith does not believe that William Brown is, and vice versa. Mental symptoms are not random. They follow distinct patterns, and that is extremely important. They're not just random. When a film writer writes to create somebody who they think is mad, unless they are aware of the patterns of mental illness, they'll get it wrong. Delusion is a false, unshakable idea or belief which is out of keeping with the patient's educational, cultural, and social background. It is held with extraordinary conviction and subjective certainty. It is experienced as an everyday notion rather than a creedal statement, and is believed on delusional grounds. Why can faith not be delusional? Well, people with a religious faith often hold beliefs that others find quite unacceptable or false or extraordinary. But this does not make them delusional or mad. Even for very bizarre and socially unacceptable religious sects, there are reasons why the beliefs are not delusions. Firstly, they're not out of keeping with that individual's cultural and social background. Other members of the church or even cult share these extraordinary beliefs. They are not necessarily held on delusional grounds. If you ask, why do you believe that? The likely answer to be given is that these are the doctrines of their group. Religious beliefs are spiritual, abstract, and not concrete or physical. when a Christian says that Jesus Christ is inside me, he is describing a spiritual event. It would be unthinkable to try and determine which bodily organ he was within. Religious beliefs are held with insight. The believer can understand others not believing, and he or she can understand doubt. For religious people without mental illness, bizarre thoughts and actions do not occur in other areas of life not connected with religion. They can give a clear and uncomplicated account of how to walk to the bus stop or of their mother-in-law's recent illness. Religious ideation and predominant thinking is a description of content and does not affect the form of thinking. Delusion is a disorder of form, and this is irrespective of the content. Of course, a person with a religious belief may also develop a mental illness, of which suffering delusions may be a part. The two, belief and illness, may occur together. But when they do, the religious belief, as such, has not caused the illness. Neither is religiosity solely an expression of a disordered mind. Could faith be a psychiatric symptom other than delusion? Psychiatric symptoms, what people experience and suffer, follow certain patterns, as I've said before. They're not arbitrary. Faith cannot just be an expression of delusion. Are there other psychiatric symptoms that could account for religious belief? Overvalued idea, Cyrano de Bergerac. Overvalued idea is a reasonable idea pursued beyond the bounds of reason. Is religion just taking an idea to excess, like thinking one's nose is so utterly ugly that the only solution is to take one's own life? No, most believers do not believe in that way at all. In the opinion of militant atheists, the idea itself, the belief, is not reasonable or comprehensible. Shared fundamental beliefs do not usually have the quality of overvalued idea. Culturally shared beliefs can be bizarre and irrational in nature, like the belief shared by most trainee nurses, apparently, in Zambia. We were told that the reason they had great difficulty in recruiting nurses to the mental hospital was that the nurses had an idea that you can catch mental illness from the patients. However, there's no automatic connection between such a culturally shared belief and religious experience. Paranoid ideas of self-reference, believing oneself to be persecuted, are not infrequent either, especially in those actually subjected to persecution. It may occur with those with religious beliefs, but there's no necessary causal relationship between the two. Abnormal mood states may occur in which the content is religious. This does not mean that the mood state was caused by religion. And the picture is of William Cooper, who wrote both John Gilpin Was a Citizen of Credit and Renown, a very amusing poem, and also God Moves in a Mysterious Way His Wonders to Perform, which was written at a time that he knew full well that he was gradually going into yet another severe depressive episode. So he had both religious belief and recurrent mental illness with a mood disorder throughout his life, but one did not cause the other. And you can get that from reading his biography. Hearing the voice of God is not necessarily an auditory hallucination, nor a pathological experience. And if I say this to you, I think it doesn't, you don't bat an eyelid. But if I said it to some psychiatrists, they would think, of course, hearing voices means that the person is mentally ill. The Old Testament prophets, St. Paul, and many people today speak of hearing the voice of God. Are all these people describing hallucination, that is, a perception without an object? No, this voice that they're describing is not experienced as something outside self, nor as a sensation that another person might hear. Quite often, it has an as-if quality to it. The subject describes it as spiritual, abstract, and not concrete or physical. 25 out of 40 members of an English Pentecostal church described hearing the voice of God. Simon Dean, the author of the paper, concluded that this experience was not necessarily evidence of psychopathology, and many of the subjects reported the voice to be helpful in situations of doubt or difficulty. The experience that has been described, the expressions in Christ, with Christ, Christ in me, which are often used by Christians, are spiritual rather than concrete in form. They're not explained by a psychotic passivity experience, nor dissociative trance in possession disorder. Belief in the indwelling of God is neither delusional nor evidence of other symptoms. Those who do not believe in God may not realize what the experience of God to the believer can mean or is like. Any or all of these symptoms that I've just described may occur in an individual with religious belief, but they're not specific to believers, and the symptom is not the only cause of belief, nor its consequence. Finally, is it psychiatric illness or religious experience? Psychiatric illness, as opposed to what is not illness, but religious experience, psychiatric illness would be suggested by the following. The person's description of their inner state and observed behaviour conform with known psychiatric symptoms. They're not recognisable as being other than that, but they are part of a psychiatric illness. For instance, it has the form of delusion. An inpatient believed with complete certainty that everyone coming onto her ward in the hospital nodded in her direction because they knew, in her words, that she was a secret emissary of the Holy Spirit. Form of delusion. They are recognizable symptoms of mental illness in areas of life other than religion. These may include delusions, hallucinations, disturbance of mood, or thought disorder. A person with religious delusions also believed that gas was being pumped through her front door and making her sporadically unconscious. The lifestyle, behaviour, and direction of personal goals of the individual after the religious experience are consistent with the natural history of a mental disorder rather than with a personally enriching life experience. I once visited an unhappy young man living on his own without any occupation in a filthy, chaotic one-room flat, whose only friends and contacts were in a local church. His lifestyle demonstrated his psychiatric disorder, irrespective of his beliefs. He, in fact, was suffering from schizophrenia. The thoughts and actions of a person with schizophrenia are often concrete, physical, and not abstract or spiritual. Beliefs may be acted on literally. If he describes Christ being in me, he might well be able to state in which organ of his body Christ could be located. The person without mental illness, but with religious conviction, shows quite different behaviour. The following indicate the person's belief and are unlikely to signify psychiatric illness. Religious experiences are usually regarded by the believer as being metaphorical or spiritual, whilst with mental illness the experience may be concrete, physical. For the religious person, the physical boundaries of self are not invaded. In fact, the paradox the Christian describes when Christ lives in him is that he is a freer person, more independent of external influence, with a greater degree of internal locus of control. The person shows thoughtful reticence in discussing his experience, especially with those he anticipates will be unsympathetic. The believer describing a religious experience will choose carefully to whom he or she talks, the situation in which this conversation takes place, for example, perhaps just the two of them, and the words and phrases used are chosen carefully to describe the experience, bearing in mind that the other may be unconvinced. It's described unemotionally with matter-of-fact conviction and appears authentic. There's often a degree of surprise that he or she has had such an experience. The person understands, allows for, and even sympathizes with others' incredulity. He may have some doubts concerning the meaning of the experience for himself. Religious beliefs are held alongside the possibility of doubt. In this, they are like any other abstract concept. He usually considers that the experience implies some demands upon his own manner of life. Religious experience provoke sustained, meaningful, goal-directed, and often altruistic activity. The religious experience conforms with the subject's recognizable religious traditions and peer group. One can see certain patterns emerging in different religious traditions. For example, speaking in tongues or carrying my cross indicate differences in religious background, not in psychopathology. It's necessary to say again that religious experience and psychiatric symptoms quite often coincide, as they are both relatively frequent in the population. If they do, it's often possible to assess what part is religious and what part is the delusional or the other abnormality of mind in that person's thinking. Faith is not delusion. There is no evidence of psychiatric disorder in the majority of the faithful. Faith is not deliberate falsehood. It's not a shared pretense, nor an obligatorily imposed belief. The hostility between religious faith and psychiatry is historical and no longer relevant. There is no fundamental difference of opinion between Christian faith and scientific psychiatry. Far from being harmful, faith is beneficial for mental health. Delusion is a precisely defined psychiatric concept and is very different from religious belief. Religious faith is not of itself delusional and is not evidence for any other psychiatric symptoms. Usually, there are clear differences between psychiatric illness and religious experience. From the psychiatric and psychological standpoint, Christians need not be reticent about their faith. Belief is a positive factor in promoting health and combating illness. For this reason, doctors should never disparage their patients' religious beliefs, but recognize them as something which can be promoting both health and recovery from illness. If doctors do cast scorn on sincerely held beliefs and thereby cause the patient distress, they are transgressing their professional code. The General Medical Council has stated, if a doctor was to put pressure on a patient to justify their Christian beliefs and or sought to impose their own non-Christian beliefs on a patient, then this would necessarily or potentially represent an infringement of our personal beliefs guidance. Faith is spiritual, positive, and subject to possible doubt. It can be corrupted, but it cannot be classified as a morbid or psychiatric phenomenon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Sims. That was extremely interesting, and I'm sure we'll raise questions amongst the group here, so I'll just open it up to anybody who wants to kick us off. Yeah, we have in back.
I was wondering, what's the difference between a delusion and something that is just a theoretical like framework that's false? So I'm thinking of like a really ambitious entrepreneur in the U.S., like Elon Musk.
Yes.
There's this really interesting YouTube video where Elon Musk is at a Tesla, the electric car shareholder meeting, and this guy, can't remember his name, but he stands up and he says, Elon, you know, my name is, you know, John. You don't know this, but I'm the best person you can possibly pick for the Tesla shareholder meeting. Obviously, he's a crazy guy. He just sounds crazy. He lists just a bunch of reasons that are ridiculous. But what's the difference between him and, let's say, Elon Musk's theoretical framework for, like, Tesla, where he says that he wants to, SpaceX, where he wants to die on Mars, is just completely false. And he just doesn't have the operational capability to do that, but he thinks that he does. What's the difference between him and the guy in the Tesla shareholder meeting who just doesn't realize he has doesn't have the operational capacity?
Yes. Well, I don't know him, and I haven't read what he actually says, but the vast majority of scientists, when they propound something, it is a hypothesis. That is, they are quite ready. They don't want it to happen, but they're quite ready for somebody to try and disprove their hypothesis. That's the nature of science. Person with a delusion, it's a false, unshakable idea or belief. They usually hold it as an ordinary, everyday notion. If I ask you, what are you doing at the moment, you would say, I'm sitting on a chair. And you have the belief that you're sitting on the chair, and it happens to be true. A person with a delusion might also say, I'm doing this, which is evidently to you and to me not true, but they still hold it with that sort of assumed belief. Nothing highfalutin or creedal about it. It's not a belief, it's more of a notion. So that would be a difference. It's out of keeping with the person's educational, cultural, and social background. The person with proves to be an unacceptable social or scientific idea or mathematical idea, it is within their own culture and within their own social background, so that they wouldn't start having theories about playing cricket or some completely different realm of life. It can be challenged on that basis. It may well have been held with extraordinary conviction and subjective certainty, but the major test is what happens when it is successfully challenged. And I don't know whether he has been successfully challenged.
Okay. And then, I don't need to ask that question, but I guess I am.
I think one answer is setting an unreasonable goal is different from a delusion, because a delusion is something you achieve, it's not something you hope for. So my brother, who's a schizophrenic, thinks he was shot and went to another planet and came back and he served in the Falklands War. So these are not things he's trying to do, it's things he convinced. I think the straightforward answer is it's part of the culture in North America, particularly US, to think big. To say, I'm going to try to do something nobody's ever done. Maybe it's not possible, but at least if I don't go for it, we'll never really know. So that's a sense which I doubt that Musk is delusional. He's just set ridiculously ambitious target and may live to eat his words. But he hasn't said that he's done it. That would be delusion to say he's done it. He's already done it.
And then, that's actually a lot, but what about false a-priori truths? Like, false a-priori truths that are held that are potentially outside of the culture. So, like, about Al-Ghazali, who came up with the ontological argument, basically says God exists, and we know this a priori, regardless of what anybody says. And he holds this with complete conviction, I don't know, like, maybe it's, you know, outside his culture, because nobody has ever come up with this argument. I don't know, I guess I'm just kind of... I'm wondering why these sorts of things aren't classified as delusions, if they're false, which I actually think that's true. But
he's mistaken rather than deluded. I think it's part of delusion, when you see a lot of it, is that it's not this sort of big creedal idea. It's much more likely to be an ordinary, everyday, quite physical idea, there are Russian battleships travelling down the high street. Now, it's not a philosophical or remote idea, but it's highly physical, and it's of course totally impossible.
Do you think it would be fair to characterize your argument as a negative argument, in the sense of sort of saying Christianity is not... Well, I guess that's kind of probably the terms you've couched in, rather than...
Yes.
Do you think your argument gives any positive evidence for Christianity?
I haven't tried to do it in that part of the argument.
Yeah.
I have tried to do it in terms of it is unquestionable now that overall, epidemiologically... religion is good for health, and that is, I think, a very positive statement, because a lot of Dawkins and some other writers' arguments have been religion is bad for your mental health. This was actually stated in the 90s by several authors, and it is manifestly not true now we have the evidence to look at. So that is positive.
So given that this could, you know, include a number of religions, you know, could be consistent with this, could be not delusional. Is there anything, you know, unique about the Christian religion that you've observed that is, you know, beneficial for positive for mental health or, you know, society or, you know, something like that? Is there anything that?
Well,
or is it sort of spirituality generally, and Christianity maybe just one of, you know, another hundred, you know, on
I've got three answers, and I hope I'll remember all three by the time I've done the first two. First thing, the evidence. The evidence is based in this big book by Koenig et al., Handbook of Religion and Health. They've got 3,000 plus follow-up studies, and I don't want to go into the detail, but overall, there is a strong correlation between religious belief and practice and better health, put it as simply as that. Now, these 3,000 studies, the greatest number were from North America, quite a lot from Europe, and lesser numbers from elsewhere. Of the American and European, a huge majority were based on Christian populations, a few on Jewish, and almost none on other religions. And so we can be fairly sure of their evidence as far as Christianity is concerned. It is a bit of an extrapolation to say that other religions also may cause benefit. There have been a few studies, both in Islam and Hinduism, and they have shown some benefit. However, I personally, as an epidemiologist, I do not know how I could construct a study based on Islam, because within an Islamic culture, you are not allowed to say that you're not religiously involved. So how they could get a control group of people who are not religious, I don't know. And any way around that is possible, but it's not satisfactory. So I was just going to say that when I talked about depression, I did specifically use the word Christian, because there has been a bit of a difference there found between the Christians, who definitely had a better outcome, and Jews, who some of the studies show that they had a worse outcome. And this may well be something genetic in the Jewish population. So that's the third thing I was going to say. And it's gone out of my head.
Well, we have another one in the back there.
Thanks for that talk, very interesting. I have a question, actually, good thing on the slide right here, about the very definition of delusion. Is it entirely a relativistic concept, or is there anything actually objective about it? Because if I'm reading that correctly, I see three things. The first is the false unshakable. Second is out of keeping with cultural background. And the third is held with conviction. Mm. Now, the third is, we can argue that's objective, but that isn't necessarily a bad thing. But on the first two, you can think of statements that over history were sometimes believed to be true, sometimes held to be false. And then likewise, the second one is very clearly a relativistic thing. So just to give one really crazy example, the early Christian evangelists at the end of the first century AD, who went from modern Middle East to modern India, they would have turned up and said, oh yeah, by the way, we don't believe in this reincarnation thing. Wouldn't that be delusional in first century India?
No, it wouldn't be delusional. It would be unacceptable. I also have share your dislike of the definition, but really from the opposite point of view, I think that if we're talking about subjective experience, which we are, the whole definition should be in subjective experience. And in a sense, what I don't like about this is that it's forcing my ideas as a psychiatrist of a delusion upon somebody else. And I would rather have something that was purely subjective in its description, but I can't construct it, I don't know how to. So I agree that it's limited, but I think it's the best we have at the moment.
What other factors did these experiments allow for? Because I can imagine if you've got a depressed person that won't leave the house, that they might force themselves out of the house to go to church, but not for anything else. And that would obviously help.
Yeah. Well, the trouble with epidemiological studies is that it never takes into account the individual case. And all of us, probably, those of us who have lived with and had Christian experience ourselves for a number of years, will know of Christians who have actually been harmed by their own particular religious belief. So it's not overall, it's not universal, but it's just to say that if you take a study such as the critics would take of thousands of people, then using the methods of epidemiology, those with Christian or with religious belief and practice have a better outcome than those without. The person you talked about, the person who has a religious belief and is able to go out to church, actually there's a case study of that in the recent book that we're publishing next month, almost exactly that, a person who had long-term mental illness and not quite so long-term Christian experience, and it actually shows how the Christian experience was helpful for her in dealing with that mental illness. But if you take individual cases, you're talking about something different, of course.
How about in cases, you mentioned thoughtful reticence and having sort of thought.
Yes.
And in cases where somebody doesn't have that, and yet for all intents and purposes, their faith is pretty much identical in terms of content, someone who does have a thoughtful reticence or is a bit more open to the possibility that they're wrong, or they at least, or a conversation with somebody who doesn't affirm their beliefs, they do express that thoughtful reticence, but then there's somebody else who does not. Because I swear I've met these people, and I don't know that I would call them delusional necessarily, but
yes.
Is that on its own enough to be a delusion, or would that have to be also in...
I think you would need a bit more to it.
Right.
Well, certainly, I think a lot of us know people whose religious ideas are extraordinary, but I feel that this idea that there is the possibility of doubt is very important. I first came across this a long time ago when I was sitting at lunch with a colleague who was a Roman Catholic Christian psychiatrist, and he sat there for several minutes without saying anything. And then he said, "I think the difference between somebody who's deluded and somebody like us who holds strong religious beliefs is that we are able to perceive the possibility of doubt." I think it's very, very important, that possibility of doubt. Not necessarily doubt about the fundamentals, but doubt about whether I've got it right, whether I've interpreted things right, and so on.
Right.
So this element of doubt, I think, is profoundly important for really any sort of philosophical idea or religious idea or spiritual idea, and it's not part of the mindset of the person with a mental illness.
Right. I imagine there must also be cases of people who doubt to the point of sort of intellectual paralysis, and then
yes,
becomes
absolutely
also a,
yes, and we know of people like that, and who's ruined their health and also ruined their religious experience. Yes.
Does it need to be patently false? And for example, when I saw this, it reminded me of a man I know from America who is a essentially retired string theorist. So he is used to theorizing about other universes and
yes,
these sorts of ideas. And he has an unshakable belief in the truth of string theory. Almost to the point of belligerence. Actually, probably
yes,
he would be belligerent. And I know there are other people out there, one of whom has a very large presence on the internet. Ten years ago...
he might have an overvalued idea. Serrano Kibota.
My question is not so much today, because I think there's still, in the physics community, it is still part of the culture. Most theorists are at least sympathetic to string theory. 10 years ago, there would have been much more sympathy. But I can imagine a situation in a generation or two when string theory has been around for 50, 60, 70 years, and there's still no evidence, and there's still no concrete principle or formula that in principle could be tested.
Yeah.
There's a website called Not Even Wrong where a physicist criticizes string theory for not even being possibly wrong, because it's a fanciful idea. If I said there are fairies in the room, there's no way to test it, so it's not even a wrong concept. So if the tide swings so far in the other direction, and people like my friend hold on to the belief, 50 years down the road, and it's unshakable, and the field has moved on, and no one else predominantly believes in string theory, would it be safe to say that, although perhaps not now, but in 30 or 40 years, he's delusional?
No, it wouldn't be safe. I was talking with Mark, I think, earlier, about a fascinating book called Religious Fanaticism, which was set in rare and wonderful American sects in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and the authors writing up and experiencing these groups. And all these people had extraordinary ideas, but you read each one, and it's not mentally ill. It's somebody who is very, very eccentric. And I think we have to tolerate people being eccentric without jumping in and saying that they're mentally ill.
May I now follow up? About a year after I met him, I'd already learned all about his beliefs in string theory. He started telling me that he was certain that 9/11 was an inside job. And he actually came up with a highly sophisticated theory of how Dick Cheney orchestrated the whole thing, and only let three other people know. He had such a sophisticated plan that only four total people in America knew about this inside plot.
Yes.
He should run for president.
Well, there are a lot of people with persecutory ideas, but it doesn't necessarily make them mad. There are also people, for instance, at the moment, who believe the government is deliberately making the health service fail so that they can close it down altogether. Depending on your political ideas, you may regard that as mad or as perfectly understandable. But, you know, because an idea appears to be bizarre, doesn't necessarily make it mad. There are other possible explanations. So,
could I say something which is partly to you, Professor, partly to the audience, which is,
I want to ask you, how many people actually know somebody who is mentally, who is mad, who is schizophrenic? Okay. I think what the professor is trying to tell us is that when you work with people who are really good,
it's very different.
Delusions, or put them into mental hospital. There are a whole family of things that those people do, disorders of thought, that are just quite different from the whole range of religious thinking. So, yes, he hasn't offered you a neat definition of delusion, because what he's really saying is they're out there. I've studied them all my life, and they're not like ordinary religious people either, some of the religious. Mm. I know this by accident, because one of my brothers is schizophrenic. And we all worry initially that, you know, maybe I'm going that way and so on. But actually, over time, that there's massive disturbance of all sorts of thinking in most schizophrenics. Mm. And it is sometimes, rarely has a religious component. But, you know, I could make you feel that you are losing your marbles just by talking like my brother does for a while. Because after a while you begin to worry about whether your own grip on the world is losing. So I think that's the main thing he's saying. Is I've lived with delusives all my life, so to speak, and they just don't look like religious people.
One of the, in the chapter I have in the book that's coming out next month, I quote a study that was done in the Religious Institute, Religious Experience Institute here in Oxford. What's it called?
Alistair Harding.
Sorry?
Alistair Harding.
Alistair Harding, yes. And they studied, I think it was 3,000 cases, looking for those where it was difficult to decide whether it was mental illness, delusion, or religious experience. And out of the 3,000, they found three where the margins seemed to be blurred, and they called these psychotic, non-illness psychotic experiences. Now, you read these three cases, they're nothing at all like a person with mental illness. They are a person who has looked in great detail at life, and they have some fairly odd ideas, but it's nothing like the pattern of mental illness. And I come back again to that word pattern. It's not arbitrary, it conforms with certain patterns. And it would take me all night to tell you about those patterns.
Do I have time for maybe one more? I was hoping that would happen so I could ask you. So one more question. A question about that distinction between form and content.
Yes.
And so you brought up William Cooper.
Yes.
And it's hard. And so I looked at him a little bit for my master's thesis. Mm. And of course, it's hard when you're looking at somebody in history, because you're dealing with sources and who knows what really Absolutely. Happened and how things really were. But one question I do have about that is whether you think... low mood or like sort of an affective disorder like that, like depression, is form, and then content might be the ideas that drive it or that sort of populate that mood. Is that a way of putting it? So is it possible that, do you think, that the content or an idea could lead then to the form? So like in William Cooper's case, where he worried that he was condemned by God and that he was... sort of a castaway, or that he was eternally condemned. Mm-hmm. But maybe, is it possible that somebody could obsess about an idea like that long enough that they could then become...
I'm not going to say anything's impossible, but I think in his case, in the autobiography, he had the ideas of despair, doubt, eternal punishment, and so on, years before he had a personal religious experience. His first episode of mental illness was in his early 20s, I think. And who knows what sparked it off, but one thing that certainly sparked it off was that his uncle, I think, wanted him to take a very public position, and being a very retiring person, he was terrified of this. This was certainly one of the triggers to his mental illness. Certainly at that time, he was not involved in anything more than other people were in religion or religious belief. When he did first hear the gospel from his cousin, Martin Madan, his first reaction was he couldn't take anything out of it. He was still profoundly depressed, and it just passed over him. And then about 6 months later, when he was beginning to come out of that depressive episode, and again, you can give various reasons why he was coming out, but we don't know, we weren't there. As he came out, he began to think through all Madan had said to him, and he thought, I am saved by grace. And he was able to take it for himself in a way that he couldn't when he was still profoundly depressed. Mm-hmm. For me, I think that the lesson I would learn is that there are times when it's hopeless to preach to somebody with depression. You've got to help them to get out of it first, and then they might be in a position to understand what it is. His last episode of mental illness was shortly before he died, and again he wrote that most appalling poem about despair and eternal damnation and so on. And I think we do have to see that in the context of his mental illness and not in the context of loss of faith and belief. So I would see it as his whatever the causes, he was depressed, and then he took on board faith, not that he had a faith which made him depressed.
Right.
And I think reading Fair biographies, that comes through very clearly.
Yeah. That's been my experience. Great. Okay, well, let's thank Professor Sims again. That was...